Welcome to Casterbus. My name is Christian Corley. And first of all, very happy 2026 to you all. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for your continued support. Can you believe Brian Turnover and myself recorded the very first Casterbus podcast in 2007? Which means this is our 19th year of podcasting, which is incredible. These days, it's myself and James McLean. He'll be along in a moment. We're going to be discussing The War Between the Land and the Sea, a serial, a five-parter, that promised to perhaps maybe restore the general position, the status quo of Russell T. Davies and the Doctor Who world, etc. The big question is, did that really happen? Is that how it worked out? We first published this podcast as a video podcast on our Patreon. Members of our Patreon get episodes of the podcast early, ad-free, and often with extra content. You can join over at patreon.com/Casterbus. The link is in the show notes. There is a trial option. So if you're interested in supporting us with just a small amount, you can do that and head over there to do that over at patreon.com/Casterbus. Now, I do refer in this week's podcast to a review that I've written of The War Between the Land and the Sea. It's the first time I've written a review of a TV show of anything in a very long time. And you can read that on our Substack. That's at casterbus.substack.com. Again, link in the show notes. And I would encourage you to subscribe to that to ensure you get those updates in your inbox. It's usually one or two per week. Now, before we go into this week's podcast, you may have noticed that this is number 499. Regular listeners will know that we're not entirely sure how many podcasts we have actually recorded, but it would seem that we're in the 500 zone. To commemorate that, and because we don't know exactly which episode is or was 500, we've got a collection of discussions coming up over the coming weeks, which we we'll be using to kind of look back on the podcast and the things that we did both on the podcast and as Casterbus.com, the old website, and the various projects that we did through that, such as the magazines and the book and the comic strips. So that's coming up in the next few weeks. Okay, so as I say, this week's podcast is myself and James McLean discussing The War Between the Land and the Sea. James McLean is with me. We are going to be discussing The War Between the Land and the Sea, the five-part Doctor Who spin-off that kicked off on BBC One and BBC iPlayer on December the 7th and then proceeded to have a weird sort of double bill, weekly double bill, and then like a final standalone episode before Christmas. We've previewed this previously and we've talked about it, and I'm going to just say to James, I enjoyed it. I was pleasantly surprised, and we'll get into that a bit more first. But we haven't discussed it, so I don't know what you think of it at all.
No, no one knows what I think about it. Isn't that exciting?
Yeah.
No one knows. It's like having a small, tiny microcosm of power in a world where you are ultimately powerless. It makes me just feel a bit better in okay. These dark times. So do I want to relinquish that power? I suppose I should. I like you. I liked it. I enjoyed watching it. I watched it with family over the festive period, specifically with my mother. We sat down and we watched The War Between the Land and the Sea. I think one of the funniest things I still find with it, and it sort of goes against sort of general, my understanding of general traits in commissioning shows, is the title is just really unwieldy.
Yes.
I mean, if you speak to commissioners, they'll tend to sort of say you want to keep your title short, because ultimately, if you all imagine your program guides, when you switch on your TVs and it comes to your listings, you don't have that many characters often if things are truncated and not in space. So if you've got a very long title and people can't read what it is, they'll skip on.
Yeah.
So the War Between the Land and Sea is not very memorable. It might be memorable if you're a Doctor Who fan who remembers the line from the Sea Devils, but it feels a really odd one because it's just not memorable to me. I find it hard to remember. I always have for the last 18 months. Maybe it's just me.
No, I struggle to remember what it's called exactly. And I think the thing is, because you've got so many permutations of the wall between, it could end up as anything. Also, this isn't like a new thing, is it? Like short titles for TV shows. This is something that goes back to right almost to the beginning of television and, you know, even the theatre. Short titles are memorable.
Certainly, but as soon as you've got listings, and that is how, especially for broadcast mediums now, where most TVs, certainly in the UK, you know, will be centrally run broadcast through a program menu, and you'll have your scheduled lists, and how that sort of squares out. There is that sort of general feeling, and maybe it's changed. But I understood from commissioners I speak to was that you want to keep it tasty and short. As limited characters as you can, really. So it fits and it's easily visible and people go, oh, I know what that is, I want to watch it, rather than it sort of being lost a bit. So, yeah, it's a weird title just to start off with. But getting past the title, given that it is a story, especially to Doctor Who, which is as old as the Age of Time, it worked pretty well. I thought it worked fairly well. There was stuff I had issues with it.
Yeah. Well, we'll come to that later, because although I did overall enjoy it, I do have some problems with it at a particular stage.
I think in terms of as a short series, it stood well on its own.
Yes.
I think it was a nice, refreshing shift of gears from the main series earlier this year. And I think a little bit of a reprieve for Davis, who got a lot of flack for that second series to in terms of his own value to the franchise, that people kind of had discounted him and then were coming back, oh, actually, no, this is quite good. Even though, I mean, he wasn't the principal writer in it. The idea and everything was his and he ran it. So I think that was good for him as well.
Yeah.
And in a sense, it may have just slightly reinvigorated the franchise a little bit or given it a little more credibility. Again, in a sea itself of war between, opinions of whether Doctor Who is tired and can't go on or, you know, it was an interesting way of being slightly fresh, but as we said, falling on well-trodden ground.
Yes. There are numerous things we can talk about. We haven't really talked about the casting at any point, particularly because, you know, we didn't really know what was going on with it, and then it was put off for months and months and months with the schedule, etc. So you've got Russell Tovey, who I think is one of the... he's a very good character actor, isn't he? He's an everyman actor. Everything just seems natural when you're watching him. I've always thought he's a good actor. I haven't seen an awful lot of stuff that he's done more recently. I don't think I've seen anything past that episode of Ashes to Ashes, actually, to be honest. But he's a great centre point for the series. Because it grounds him, because he's just like the man just thrown in to this crazy situation, isn't he?
And he's built.
He is.
He was showing some. He was showing some guns there. There was some heft. I think one of my issues with the show, one of my primary issues is that, I thought he was fine throughout. I thought it was the wrong show to try and drop the everyman into, because it felt really awkward as to how it dropped the everyman into it.
There was a force to it, a forcing of...
Because he was an everyman who was already in the organisation in a way that wasn't inherently clear when he first came into it. Mm. He doesn't look like... I mean, he does have a certain look of an everyman, but the way that he appeared, as I say, pretty buff, short, fairly military haircut, which I know is what he tends to have anyway, but he didn't come across like an everyman thrust into the situation. It felt the script was having to do a lot of heavy lifting to remind everyone that this person did not belong to this job and what this guy's job was. And this guy's job was not something that I think people quite would naturally understand or relate to, should I say. If he'd been a postman who had somehow got caught into this affair, or Bob Landlord, or, you know, taxi driver. Yeah, that would be a really interesting one in terms of foreign policy.
Al Murray, the pub landlord, not Al Murray, the actual person.
Ooh, yeah, the pub landlord. Yeah, the pub landlord would be a fascinating. Yeah, that would be a parody of this show drop in. We would not be surprised if we suddenly see a slew of AI slop with Al, the pub landlord, now standing in front of Homo Aqua. Yeah, I think that to me was a problem for it. That it couldn't really sell to me that he was an outside everyday man. It tried to show you his dysfunctional family. He had him at every point early on saying that he shouldn't be there. It was a sort of kind of a mistake, but it just didn't sell it to me. It didn't feel like the Flash Gordon, you know, taken out of, to be fair, Flash Gordon, the film, has a similar problem because you never see him play American football.
Yeah.
It's doing some heavy lifting in that show a little bit in the opening and some of the comments. But yeah, and I think that I struggled with it. And I was just thinking, I just don't think we need it. I kind of get why we do, because this idea is that Homo Aqua sort of focus on a person who's outside of the establishment as being the person that speaks for the people.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where it's from. But I just don't think they sold it well enough. It would almost been better if he'd been a taxi driver or something who had accidentally sort of got, I don't know. It's just, it just
picked
didn't,
up a sea devil.
And a taxi driver had taken the diplomat to the plane and accidentally got caught on the plane and they couldn't get him off. Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, like that guy on the BBC. Guy Gomer.
Yeah, there's countless examples in media where someone's been interviewed and they've just been, you know, someone who is not that person.
Yeah.
Just accidentally wandered onto set. So I think something like that would have worked better. So, you know, if there'd been an extra, it almost feels like, and I dare say it's an extra episode to start it, which set you on his path. And maybe that path would be one where he gets thrust into that situation in the similar way he does once they're going into the diplomatic position, where he accidentally gets caught in that space and then they can't extract him from it because he has now become integral. Yeah. That to me is where it sort of lacked. I just did not feel he was an everyman, and yet that was the whole point of it. Mm-hmm. So I struggled with that. But as I say, I think it looked good. It had lots of locations. It felt confident in tone. It felt fairly fresh, which I thought would be quite hard, given, as yes. I say, we've seen this done so many times. It felt uncomfortably real.
Yep.
Which obviously deliberately tried to be this notion of far too close ties between private org businesses and interests to government policy and government steerage. That was uncomfortably true. So there's a lot of things playing out there which we could relate to and spoke to at the times that we're in, which I think, again, was impressive and felt like what Doctor Who should be doing, even though it's not Doctor Who. It should be a commentary, a satire, a statement on where we are at the moment as a people. And I think it was doing that.
I think it did a lot better than Doctor Who's done it for a long time. I'm in the process of writing a review. I haven't written a review of anything, not a gadget, in ages. So I'm in the process of writing a review of this for our Substack. And I'm largely enjoyed it. There's a couple of things I do want to get to, like the final 15 minutes at some point, maybe in the final mm-hmm. 15 minutes of this. But there is one thing that really irritated me earlier on, and that was, this has been going on for a while, and I think I chatted with Philip about this a few weeks ago, is the naming of the Homo amphibian, Homo aqua, because Homo relates to primates. So that it's, 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 and it's, I think I've written this. There is actually a word for two-legged reptiles. Let me just find it. Bipes. So they could be called Bipes aqua or Bipes amphibia, which is I knew at the back of my mind that this was a thing, but I found this after 2 minutes of searching, like confirmed it. Perfectly good names. I think Homo aqua is a stupid name, but the casting of this is excellent.
I think with Homo aqua, in a way, it does work because it given what you've just said, just on the basis is that the world. Sort of the hooks on what becomes real, what becomes true, or no longer feel based in rigor, in accuracy. That everything and that's not necessarily to say about fake news or anything like that, but just because we're always in such a rush, there's such a saturation of stuff to deal with, that stuff sticks when perhaps it shouldn't, because it has to.
Like calling them Silurians.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it sort of makes sense, even though I think you're right. I think in the end it was done just because it was the audience would make the connection easier because they know Homo sapiens as a phrase really quite. So that, I know that's why they did it. But that's an interesting point.
Yeah, but casting of this is excellent, and I think that's another thing that attracted it to me and made me think that maybe it was actually going to be good, even though the BBC's constant shifting of the schedule made me think actually maybe they're a bit embarrassed by this.
Yeah.
So you got Colin McFarlane, who, you know, he's playing the same role he played in Children of Earth. Colin McFarlane's done loads of stuff. He's always good. He always delivers. You've also got Adrian Lucas, again, an actor who always delivers, and Vincent Franklin, whom most people probably... I mean, he's another one who's a character actor. I've seen him in lots of things. He was in a couple of Midsummers, and also Doc Martin as a semi-regular character. You've got Patrick Ballady as well, who he was in, again, done loads of things, but he was in The Office as well as David Brent's enemy. So he's done loads of stuff, obviously. And then you've got people from Doctor Who world. You've got Ruth Madeley, who, according to Wikipedia, she's Unit's 56th scientific advisor. I wonder how many of those 56 are the Doctor. you've also got Gemma Redgrave, who we'll be talking about later on, I suspect, and you've got.
But I also wonder whether Unit goes through scientific advisors like Red Shirts,
because that's what I'm thinking.
Once you've had the Doctor, you'd perhaps automatically assume that your scientific advisor would not always be right, but also someone that you'd put right in the middle of the field, because you know they're going to sort things out, and invariably they die in horrible ways each time, and you just go through them weekly.
Yes. And of course, there is Gugun Bathurau, who has committed to wearing that amazing outfit and makeup, which must have took hours of work.
There was a couple of shots near the end when they're in the sea, and I was thinking, this is the one time where you are really pushing the makeup, because most of the time through that, it looks almost skin-worthy.
Yeah.
It's really well, and that also comes down to the grading and also the little bits of posts that they're putting on top of it.
Yeah.
It looks great. But there's that bit when they're in the sea together, and it just starts to look a bit like a rubber outfit.
Uh-huh.
And I was just feeling like, you've got it so right. Did you really have to push it that far? But I suppose you had to for the story.
Yeah, possibly, yeah. So there's obviously there's all these shenanigans going on with Patrick Ballady's character, Keith Spears, and the Prime Minister, and the French and the American envoys who... You maybe thought, I certainly did, that they were in cahoots with Spears, but it wasn't apparently that close. You've got various people, you know, dying quickly, sooner than you'd expect. We've got the whole thing with the... it was some sort of explosive, wasn't there, under the water. If there are spoilers here, ladies and gentlemen, it's on iPlayer. So pause this and go and watch it, then come back if you haven't. I don't know why you'd listen to this if you hadn't watched it already, though. So there's a lot.
That does always fascinate me, because I've seen on so many commentaries over the years people sort of saying, if you've not listened to this, you've not seen a thing, don't listen to this. And part of me thinks, surely no one listens to a commentary or review on it without seeing a thing first,
Oh, they do.
Though. Without deciding that they're happy for spoilers, and then are shocked that they get spoilers.
Yeah.
But yes, yeah, there's got to be a precedent. There's got to be a type of person who does actually go to these things first and gets shocked that they learn things and gets quite annoyed. Yeah. I don't know. But it's
the people who drink boiling water and things like that out of pot noodles and stuff. Yeah, so we've got all this stuff going on. And that keeps the intrigue going. And that puts it on, for me, on the sort of a similar sort of par as Children of Earth. And there is a very good case for this being a similar intention, that it was intended to go out on a nightly basis as well. Mm. Although some time does pass between across it, so it probably takes place for more than a week. I can't remember what the time scale was of Children of Earth, but I do think it was meant to be across 5 days originally. But it was a long time ago, and a different show.
But then Davis said recently that he sees this as like a spiritual second part to Children of Earth, because it carries a very... I think his suggestion is almost that Children of Earth almost sort of sets the world up for the potential of this sort of thing happening and how they respond.
There's a lot of similarities, isn't there? Not just with the whole sort of political side of things, but even the setup of how they, you know, have a dedicated room for meeting.
Yeah.
Meeting the guests, let's call them. So you know, it's a huge lot of similarities between the two things. And I think that's a good thing, because I think Torchwood: Children of Earth is probably, I mean, it's not like the rest of Torchwood. It's it went out on BBC One. It was very memorable as a televisual event, something that has been kind of scant in the Doctor Who world, probably since. Certainly since 2013, certainly since 2023, and definitely since 2013, there hadn't really been much of an event about Doctor Who, whereas there was with that. And I think there is with this as well.
Yeah.
And I'm glad, it's good that it is now on iPlayer as well, so people are going to be able to see it. The overnights aren't going to give us an awful lot of information as to what the viewing is overall, but they were remarkably consistent around the 4 million level, over and under. And I think that's good as well.
Yeah. And I'd be interested, I'd love to see, a further breakdown of that as what has catalyzed that. Was it good advertising? Because it did get a fair bit of promotion once it was scheduled.
Sorry, I should qualify that. Sorry, James, I should just correct myself on that. The overnights were between 2.8 and 1.7. The total consolidated included viewers is between 4.3 and 3.08 for the final episode. That's not a heavy degradation across five episodes, is it? That's good.
No, yeah, absolutely. And, given the time of year as well, and given the sort of viewing numbers that we would anticipate a top end for terrestrial at the moment, that sits very nicely. Yeah. I think they should be probably quite happy with that. It's obviously depending on how much they spent on it and how much... see how it works globally as well, because I think that'll be an interesting thing. Yeah, it was a surprise. And I think it pulled a few quite risky, not punches, as say, but to have very long dialogue sequences, having a lot of stuff in the chamber and keeping that fresh and interesting each time they went in. That's not necessarily an easy thing, and that felt like a proper drama approach. It was a... It's always interesting when you get things like Children of Earth and this, and I disregard the rest of Torchwood on this point, where you have, let's not say the doctorlessness of it, but the powerful, the superhero. The superhero is removed from the formula, because most of Torchwood, you have effectively got a superhero formula. We've said this before, it's Batman in his Batcave with his Bat team. But this is very much... people working within the confines of the politics and the military, trying to solve an unearthly situation, and that's Children of Earth and this, and I think that was kind of bold to do, and I wonder where those audiences came from. Was a different type of audience watching this to who would watch Doctor Who is what I'm wondering. Mm. And also, I suppose the question on our lips as well is would that bring those people to Doctor Who Christmas next year, or will it have no impact at all? Will it be very much disassociated from that sort of connection? I don't know. I mean, I felt the points where they drop in about the Doctor were needless. I can kind of understand why they needed them in there to I felt Unit on the whole was one of the weakest things in the show. And not talking about Letter to Prince Stuart, but the use of Unit, especially as sort of little chipper one-line joke machines as things went on to try and keep everything feeling light, just really began to annoy me. I know some of these were characters which we've seen before, but I just felt they just weren't needed.
I'm a little bit baffled by Unit, to be honest with you. It doesn't really seem to have recovered.
Well, I think the problem with Unit is that Unit, since 2005, has always run... I think the point of what made Unit interesting to Doctor Who was that they were the antithesis of what the Doctor was, and yet he was forced to work with them. Mm. They were a military outfit working with traditional military strategies, which he would have to utilise to his benefit where he could, and often have to fight against when he had to.
Yeah.
Modern-day Unit is about tech, about computers, but also soldiers. But they're almost like a tech army rather than an army. And I think that is where Unit just doesn't really work for me. And in this case as well, Unit is a group of tech people. You know, they're essentially a Torchwood amalgam. They're using high-tech equipment. They're doing exactly what Brigadier never did. Utilizing technology that's advanced of the, and so they don't, they're more tortured with the Unit.
Yes, they are.
And I just don't find them interesting. I don't find them believable. I find Lethbridge Stewart, I think that role she's works that role really well now.
Yeah.
And her involvement in it was great. I think she contributed something to it as almost like a dual lead, and that really worked. But the rest of them, and again, it's no offense to the actors, and they just took away from the gravitas and the tension in the story. And I just don't think they provided any release valve either. Mm. They were just slightly irritating,
yes.
And or used as to move plot along in a certain direction.
Yeah.
And they were the weakest link for it for me. I, to be honest, no, the weakest link of it for me, my biggest issue with the whole thing is I didn't really care about anyone in it. And that's not always necessarily a bad thing. Mm. But as much as Russell is a really charming actor, I did not care for his character much. I did not care what happened to him. I did not really care about the romance. I did not care about his family. I thought his daughter was quite sweet, but ultimately still was not that invested. Lethbridge Stewart didn't massively care that much either about the stuff with everyone. Everyone was slightly grumpy and problematic. And there was... it lacked a little charm in that way. And that's not to say individually characters and actors didn't have charm, but I just didn't found, I was interested in the story. It's interested in where it went. If Russell's character died, if Salt died, even if Lethbridge Stewart died, I didn't really care that much. I just don't have that investment in them, and they didn't manage to give me that investment.
Yeah.
But that didn't necessarily mean I didn't enjoy watching what they were doing in a weird way.
Okay. This is a good point, I think, to bring this up. You have regularly observed over the years that you can't have a bad ending.
Yes, I have.
Yes.
That's fair to say. Yes.
And I have got to be honest, I thought the last 15 minutes of this was quite terrible. It's not that there was one event, it's that there was several things that happened in quick succession which really threw me and kind of took me out of it and left me wondering why I'd watched it. You mentioned the bit on the beach, and do you remember Waterworld?
Yep.
The extremely expensive Kevin Costner movie, which had to go undergo various reshoots and things. Do you know what one of the reasons for the reshoots was?
Please tell me and the listener.
Yes. The breathing mechanism, let's call it, on Kevin Costner's character resembled part of the female anatomy.
Uh-huh.
So they had to reshoot it, and it didn't do a great job. of the reshoot, it still isn't great. And I not knowing that happened, and you know, it was 30 years ago, and there's plenty of time to avoid this. This whole thing with what happens at the end to Barclay, Russell Tovey's character, I was not convinced that anyone was aware of. It just looked, it didn't sit well on the television screen for me. It was a little bit uncomfortable. So there's that. Okay, that's only a tiny part.
What was uncomfortable about it?
It didn't look as if it had made any particular inroads away from what I just described on Kevin Costner's body.
Oh, okay.
Right. So there's that. But you know, that might just be a me thing, because I was aware, I know the thing about Waterworld. Okay. But there isn't just that. There is there's the casual genocide that is pretty much skated over, really. You know? You've got, and you've got the whole thing that the brilliant, you know, that brilliant money scene at the end of episode one or two with the rubbish coming back to the surface. And largely we get to that point at the end there, and all of that's kind of forgotten, and even like these commitments, they've been forgotten. And you might remember them when you see the guy throwing the bit of rubbish on the beach, but then it's almost as if he's just come from a completely different show. He's just been created perfectly, you know, purely so that Kate can have some sort of psychotic episode on the beach. And that whole ending has just completely ruined the other, you know, four episodes and 30 minutes for me.
I didn't react as badly, as strongly as you did to that last 50 minutes. I agree with you. I felt the ending was, it felt rushed.
Yeah.
It's funny how shows do that. And sometimes you're watching a show and you think you spend four episodes waddling around the place with scenes which perhaps we didn't need.
Yeah.
Or events which we didn't need. And then we get to a point where, yeah, we've got like 15 minutes, guys, let's wrap this up. Let's genocide the race with a something which we have made an acknowledgement to over a couple of episodes, but really the sheer scale and power we've not really talked or looked at in a sense, so we can hide how we're going to resolve this.
Yeah.
But equally, yeah, I don't think the ending was great. I didn't quite feel I fully understood why he was shifting. And I think there was like, there were flags thrown on the screen at the last minute about the Accord,
yeah,
and how, what the Accord actually meant. But I just felt that rather than feeling like this was something that was left up to interpretation, it was something which just hadn't really been, hadn't landed correctly. And there'd been hints. I mean, we knew this was coming. You could see it was coming, his interest in water. They were obviously setting all that up. But there is a question again, and this is what I mean, is that it's not, it's like Mission Impossible in the 60s. Mission Impossible in the 60s was yeah, if some people listening to this probably won't have seen it. They'll have seen the films of Tom Cruise. You know, and we've talked about Mission Impossible, I think, before, in the sense that it was an incredible show that was written in a way where essentially the characters didn't matter. They had no backstories at all. Any of the agents never alluded to their backstories. I think a couple of occasions where they might have come up, but ultimately these were like pawns in a chess game that you would watch as these operatives would dismantle a uniquely named Eastern European country.
Yeah.
Slavonia or something, you know, it would be something that was, that would sound a little like it possibly comes from there, but not really enough.
Moldavania,
yeah, is that sort of thing. But what was, I think, was clever about it was that it knew what it was, that it was a puzzle. You came to watch them solve a puzzle. How could they complete an impossible mission?
Yeah.
And it was so difficult that back in the day, the writers would burn out really quickly, because to do that, 26 episodes a season was really hard. With this, I feel it's almost like the show, or even doesn't really know what its heart is, or it's trying to have two hearts, maybe. Maybe it does know what its heart is, but it's trying to have two hearts. And I think the story of, and I've forgotten his name, Russell's character's name now, but...
Barclay Pierre Dupont.
Oh, that was it, yeah. Yeah. Was not as relevant or as interesting to the audience as... Or certainly not to my audience. Maybe that's a problem now these days. You're trying to play to multiple audiences. But his romance and his outcome, I don't think I needed him to turn into a fish.
No.
It didn't serve anything for me. I just still don't see how it served the story, apart from indulging in his story. Now, maybe people, I suppose this is the question, did people connect Barclay and Salt in a way that they needed that almost more than they needed the resolution to the crisis? And in a weird way, that terrifies me, that you'd have a story which speaks to such a global crisis, which mirrors and reflects some of the discourse and concerns that we have today. And yet what is more interesting to people is where the two people continue to have it off in the sea after this finishes.
Yeah. Just a quick interruption in this week's podcast to remind you to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. A 5-star review with words will be read out. The more reviews we get, the more 5-star reviews we get, the better the standing of the podcast and the more listeners we can reach.
I would have liked to have had Salt. I know Salt obviously was, well, let's say gender fluid. I would have rather had Salt as a man and had it as a friendship, because I sometimes find one of the things in shows just generally, and the American TV has been guilty of this on so many occasions, the romance is invariably, it's very hard to make work unless you've got a very long period to play it by. You know, Monica and Chandler really only worked in Friends, and then it didn't for me anyway, because they'd had 3 seasons of getting to know those characters.
Yeah.
But quick formed romances are really hard to make people care about, because we don't really care that much about whether other people are necessarily. But we do perhaps care if we feel, you know, there's a deep friendship or a deep fraternity, or not necessarily a fraternal friendship, but certainly something which is born in a deep, more altruistic rather than selfish need for someone.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem with romances. The romances are to some degree inherently very us-focused, self-focused, you know, on our marriages, not the weirdest thing that we have to all stand and watch two people have their most private and intimate conversation to bond and pair together. And they've got to have an audience there, and it's about them, and we've got to bring presents for them, but we've got to be there just to spectate it. You know, marriages and everything is a very weird setup in themselves. Romances are inherently very, very selfish, and on TV, they can be very hard to do. And I think it would have played better to have had, you know, a powerful... You know, I don't want to say a bromance, because I don't think it doesn't have to be a guy's. I mean, if the two leads were two women, it would be the same. Or it could be, you know, just a two very, very... The problem is, as soon as you have a man and a woman having a very strong friendship, everyone's always still questioning about, do they actually, you know, is a romance there? But I think taking a romance out would have been... would have felt more in line with this programme. It felt really weird to have a personal romance going on when there was... the Armageddon of the human race, or the Armageddon of another race, or Armageddon of both races coming up. And like in episode 4, I think it is, or 3 or 4, where we have them having their sexual relations under a bridge, or in, you know, talking about how she's quite okay with how turned on he is, you know, these sort of things. It's like, really?
Yeah.
We're talking, in one moment we're talking about the devastation of everything, and now we've got to invest on whether she finds his erection palatable. I just don't, which is what the whole scene was trying to say, wasn't it? It was, you know, I'm no prude, but it's just like, there's a time and place, mate.
Yeah.
And I just feel that feels like a really weird time to get into a real intimate conversation in this story when we have all this stuff going on. We see, every time we see his daughter is distressed, not because of the loss of mummy and daddy not longer loving each other, but just because she loves her dad. And that is quite a powerful love. Yeah. And then we switch to him in a more intimate, you know, biological love, and we're just like, so the end output, as you say, of this show being, well, they're in sea together and they're happy, and you're just thinking, yeah, but I've just watched 90% of a race just floating, drowned, yeah, dead. You know, I'm cognitively working on this fact that now we're just, everything a bit like after, you know, COVID, you know, and all that stuff, and you know, the world was, there's less fumes, everything was, you know, the world had a moment to breathe, and then just everything went back to normal. And we know after this, everything will just go back to normal, yep, and, you know, sewage will still be pumping out and the waste will be going out. We know, and that's a dark ending. But no, don't worry. These two have got it on in the sea. You know, that's good. You know, everything's, and it's just like, no, I don't care about that at the moment. Yep. And it feels almost like, if this was to play true to the 70s, which invariably, if we go down to the Silurians and the Sea Devils, is where it's at. Mm. The ending, I absolutely like the Lethbridge Stewart ending with the gun on the guy on the street, the cocky guy on the beach. Sorry,
yeah.
Because it feels, I could see that at the end of a 70s drama like this as being the end out. It's almost got like an Invasion of the Body Snatcher sort of. She's almost got that sort of Donald Sutherland screaming at this guy. The camera's just intent on her. I like that. It's. And it feels more in tune with what this was all about than whether, while this is happening, there's two people having sex under the water, you know, 200 yards away. I don't care about that. I don't want to know about that particularly. Again, because it's not because it's a prude thing. It's just not relevant.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's my long answer, very long answer to your point. Okay. So I sort of agree with you on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it did. I think it does weaken the strength of the rest of it.
It does, I think. And Pete McTighe is the co-writer with Russell T. Davies, yes, on this. And this is a topic that he's touched before on the matter of sea pollution. It's also a matter I've mentioned before on the podcast, and I don't want to get bogged down into that again. I do feel that there is a very, and again with the last time McTighe was involved on the, with this particular topic, I do feel like there is a greater subtlety to the use of this particular topic in Doctor Who, or in the Doctor Who world, than there has been with other things in the Doctor Who world. Because maybe it's something to do with the actual importance of it, that it maybe doesn't need to be one of those. It doesn't become one of those things that people say the Doctor Who's preaching about, because it is a very real concern and people do know about it, and it has been a concern for decades, and it is certainly something that's been a public concern since the 1980s, certainly a mainstream concern since the 1980s. I don't want to get distracted with this, because it is a topic that's very much something that is related to, you know, my personal life and my wife's professional life. So I don't get distracted by that. But it was good to see that it was being highlighted and was the, you know, a core element of the plot rather than, you know, just brought in. The story hinges on it.
Mm. Yeah.
And I want to see more of that.
I think the powerful thing is that, and when you do this sort of stuff right, it works really well,
yeah,
where you actually are more on side with the enemy than you are with your own people, because it was one of the few times where I think they really managed to really sell why sea people have not just an indigenous right to that space, but kind of also why that space is not like them and us. That space is now being totally polluted by us, and the way they talked about that I thought was very powerful.
Yeah.
The throwing of the litter back onto land I think was a lovely statement and a reminder to everyone about how all our stuff goes into the oceans. Absolutely. And also, again, I just love the small things which, you know, both McTighe and Davies did so well, is this whole notion of like, yeah, we could say, if you want the land, fine, you can have the land, but we take the water, and if that's our territory, you can't come across it. Stuff like that. It was just really good little bits of writing. It's like, well, what does the world do then?
Yeah.
And I think Davies has always been very good at sort of pushing those topical questions in a sci-fi way, you know, which is what Children of Earth did as well. You know, how would a society react when you put these certain conditions on them? And I think it did that very well.
Yeah. Samuel Oatley was the other ambassador who succeeded Salt. He was, it turned out he was even saltier than Salt. He was quite good. He kind of made an impression. I think it's only one episode or one and a bit episodes.
Yeah.
But he really raised the stakes, that character. And so, and again, that's before the final episode happens. And I mean, I agree with many of your criticisms. I think I'm a bit tired of this sort of, I want to call it S.H.I.E.L.D. unit.
Mm.
Especially having, I watched The Avengers the other day, and I do think it's probably time to retire it. Not necessarily Gemma Redgrave, but probably the rest of it. Overall, as I say, I did enjoy it, but I was very disappointed with the final episode, and I do think it spoils it for me.
Yeah, I mean, I would either retire it or reduce it. And I think you could argue that very easily, because invariably political power does not lie. I mean, as they showed in that story, the unit has a lot of sway. So it would be very easy to defang it in terms of just reducing it and changing it as a small notional military operation.
Yeah, this is another thing. And this is something I'm like midway through writing into this review. There is and this is not a huge point, and it's not central to the review or anything, but this whole sort of... surveillance state of units. If we, it's kind of contrary to what has been established in Doctor Who since late 60s, certainly since the 1970s. The word panopticon is literally about surveillance. And the Doctor escaped Gallifrey, presumably in part because of surveillance. And here we go. He's sort of like one of his best friend's daughters is building this kind of surveillance system on Earth and utilizing it and blackmailing psychiatrists and stuff with it.
Yeah, in a sense, I mean, I like that side of Leopard Stewart. I think I've never massively liked Leopard Stewart. I've just found her a little. Charmless, and I don't think that's anything to do with the actor. It's just simply to do with the where she's positioned and how she operates. It's just sometimes a bit charmless and a bit forced, and that's the story rather than her. That's why I think I really liked the ending of this, where you, and again, I like that scene with the refusal to sign off, with the push for her to be signed off, and how she responded to that. I like that sort of side to her, that sort of edginess, I think, worked really well. But you're right. I feel the surveillance thing and this whole confusion between whether UNIT is the Avengers or whether it is Torchwood, and it doesn't have to be either. And sometimes I just, again, it's backseat driving here, but I just wish that shows would sometimes just have a little more confidence in themselves to find their heart. And I don't think this show's heart is in the tech. I don't think the story's heart was in the tech. The tech that was used on the unit side never really propelled the story in any direction. You didn't really need any of it. No. I can't think of anything that they developed or said that needed unit to be there. You know, you could have the Accord thing. There could have been other ways to deal with that. The details of their genetics and stuff doesn't have to come from unit. Unit just doesn't need to be doing this stuff. It should, in my mind, if you're going to keep UNIT, keep it as, and this is, again, people like, this is the other problem with UNIT, is that people like an underdog. They don't like people who are in control. As soon as UNIT's in control, people don't like them. Mm. It was the whole point of Torchwood. You know, as soon as Torchwood was a mass surveillance thing at the end of series two, you know, they're the enemy. Yeah. We don't like it. We want them to be an underdog. We want them to be underutilized, undervalued. And that's how they become the sort of friend of the Doctor, in a sense, the friend of the underdog. And they just haven't been that since they've come back. And it's not hard to make them that. And then that then becomes their tension, is that they don't have access to all the resources, but they still have the drive to do what is right, which is kind of what the unit should be about. And that's what you, I mean, you never did have, they had the doctor and they had guns and that was it.
Yeah.
And then they always had the oversight, which was always undermining them. That's the power in them. And I don't see why, and it's not about going back to the right time of UNIT, but just going and putting UNIT into a place where dramatically it's sympathetic to the audience. And it's just not at the moment. And they're not the Avengers. We don't need to copy that. These days, maybe copying Marvel's not the best idea anyway. So why don't we just, like I said, I feel this show would have done better if it just stripped out so much of its character stories. It's not a story about characters. And I know they would say this is ultimately the heart of story being between two people from two different warring factions. It shouldn't be. And it still can be, but it doesn't have to be a romance. You know, I just think we need to get away from that. Society needs to get away from the fact that everything has to come down to romance, because romance is not spiritual. You know, romance is a varying degrees of boning. It's not, you know, if you want to fight,
I'm putting that out as a clip.
you want to do about love. I find in TV and film, the best love comes when you've got fraternal or sibling love or generational love, you know, through families or friendships. Those are the most powerful things. It's not, I think, you know, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, you know, the final shot of them, there's, you know, that has more power than if they were sort of romantically entwined. You know, when it's people actually fighting for each other, not because they find them biologically attractive, but because they genuinely care for that person.
Yeah.
That is so powerful. And we seem to lose sight of that. And I think that, they're, in a weird way, their love for each other in this undermines the point of the show about people coming together, not people with an agenda. Because in the end, he's rushing after Salt, not because he feels getting Salt on side might help them save billions of lives. He's trying to get Salt because he fancies her.
Yeah.
And it's just like that, to me, feels reductive. I'm watching this guy and it's kind of embarrassing where the world is falling apart and all you're thinking about is someone that you fancy. We just need to find I've found some world TV does do it well. I find if you watch like Korean television, certainly Japanese television as well, you know, if it's about romance, it'll be about romance. But if it's not about romance, the romance will not be playing, will not be conflicting for its lead. It will not be there at the front. And we just seem at the West, us in America especially, we just do this all the time.
Well, it's not something that's always been there, though, is it? You know, you can go back to, say, the 70s and you wouldn't...
British stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in American stuff we would. But in British stuff, but certainly British sci-fi or British... I was thinking, obviously, like Blake 7. A good example where, you know, there was very little romance in there in any form whatsoever. Yeah. But even in things like Space 1999, which was, you know, co-pro-American thing with Gerry Anderson. But even in the basis of that, romances were very limited.
Yeah.
You know, they did not really push things forward, you know. I don't know. It's something that's long-term frustrated me.
Yeah.
And this is a good example of why. And I think you just can't have the two. You can't be trying to get audiences invest in the needs of the many. And then also sometimes put that aside and say it's actually about the needs of the few.
Yeah.
Or the one.
If you're listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts and everywhere else, then you need to subscribe to the podcast through Patreon to listen to the extended version of the podcast. And for you, it's the end of the show.
Thank you very much, James, for joining me this week. Thank you for watching and listening, and we'll be back for another show soon. Until then, it's goodbye from us.